Jimmy Breslin was impatient, but he tried to make us understand.
And I walked into the kitchen just as they were breaking from their rally. And I'm in the kitchen, and this guy holds the gun out at Kennedy and shoots.
Bob Michael failed to lead the House Republicans to the majority, but his love affair with Congress never weakened.
Mr. Speaker, you and I have served in this body together since 1965, but we have forged a friendship for one another based on our mutual respect and love for this institution.
And John Anderson wanted to become president, but refused to offer up easy solutions.
Let me tell you that I, first of all, oppose an election year tax cut.
Just a few of the political giants who passed away this year. We'll remember the legacies that they and others left behind. Coming up on the Political Junkie 2017 Remembrances Special. Thanks for joining us for this special edition of the Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. 2017 started most improbably, the inauguration of Donald Trump as President of the United States. And it ended pretty much the same way, the election of a liberal Democrat to fill a Senate seat in Alabama. In between, we lost many of the norms we used to have in politics, and a startling rise in mistrust, misstatements, recriminations, name-calling, and deceit. Only in 2017 could we learn about UFO sightings and agree that they were far more believable than what we've been hearing from our political leaders. As disheartening as much of the year has been, it was much sadder when you think about whom we lost. Giants in the political world who are no longer with us. Senators, governors, House members, committed liberals, dedicated conservatives, public servants, activists, journalists. For better or worse, these people helped make our lives more interesting and tried, in their own way, to make the world a better place. And joining me in this remembrance are Stu Rothenberg, the longtime campaign analyst who's a senior editor at Inside Elections, and Jill Lawrence, a columnist and commentary editor at USA Today. Jill and Stu, it's great having you on this week.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thanks, Ken. Nice to be here.
I'd like to start with two who were presidential hopefuls, although obviously they were clear long shots. John Anderson was a Republican congressman from Illinois who, in the middle of his 1980 bid for the GOP presidential nomination, decided to run as an independent.
Do you really think that our economy is healthy? Do you really think that 8 million Americans being out of work and the 50% unemployment among the youth of our country are acceptable? Do you really think that our armed forces are really acceptably strong in those areas of conventional capability where they should be? Do you think that our political institutions are working the way they should when literally only half of our citizens vote? I don't think you do think that. And therefore, I think you ought to consider doing something about it and voting for an independent in 1980.
Jill and Stu, I assume the two of you remember way back in 1980 that independent presidential candidate?
I do remember him. One of the things that's so memorable about him is that there's hardly anyone left like him anymore. He was a moderate Rockefeller Republican. He wanted to raise the gas tax. He put himself out there in the year when Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan were on the ticket, and those two were very different. And so it seemed like there might have been some appetite for a third-party candidate, or an independent candidate. It just went the way of most independent candidacies. So
I was going to say, Stu, and he started out as a very conservative Republican.
Yeah, well, to me, the lesson of all this is how dramatically the parties have changed, how the country has changed, and how our politics has changed. I mean, Republicans now look back on Ronald Reagan as this political messiah of conservatism, but you didn't have to go that much earlier than that to see a Republican Party that included Nelson Rockefeller and Jacob Javits and a lot of moderates and liberals. And John Anderson came out of that strain, except that he was more conservative than they were. They were the big New York, let's build monstrous buildings in New York City.
John Lindsay, right.
So, but he had kind of the tone of those, and he wanted to do well, but he was not a conservative ideologue as much. He was a kind of pragmatic conservative. And now looking back, he looks like a flaming left-wing Republican who would be a liberal Democrat now.
Well, actually, Ronald Reagan kind of looks like that now,
that's
too.
Right.
Doesn't he?
That's right.
Well, Jill, you mentioned the fact that he took unpopular positions. I mean, for somebody who ostensibly wanted to be president, he certainly didn't grovel to the voters.
Well, you know, there was a kind of a whole genre of presidential candidates who used to be truth tellers and tell people what they didn't want to hear. I'm thinking of Paul Tsongas on the Democratic side and to some extent Jimmy Carter as president. And, you know, I guess people used to, before Republicans got into the mindset that all they could offer was tax cuts, and, you know, there were real policy ideas out there that may not have always worked out for the candidates, as we see what happened to those candidacies. So, you know, maybe that was one of the last gasps or, you know, last decade of trying to run like that.
But Ken, one thing that struck me about that clip, and that's the John Anderson that I remember, is he often lectured voters. He had this air of superiority where Ronald Reagan was this aw shucks conservative who understood the modern media, I think, better than John Anderson.
John Anderson was not a laugh riot, shall we say.
Unlike Mitch McConnell.
Right. No, but you're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, he basically said, eat your spinach. He was an eat your spinach kind of candidate. Yeah,
traditionally, that hasn't worked well for presidential races,
no.
Has it?
You know, I recently spoke to one of his children, Diane Anderson, about her father.
He was a trailblazer, and I think he was very prophetic back in 1980 and even before then, as he evolved from a conservative Republican to a moderate to a liberal on social issues. He proved that politicians can evolve, that they can listen, and they can be flexible.
Well, another thing I think of when I think of your father is that he had and I think of that 1980 campaign the most, but he was also in the leadership of the Republican Party in Congress for many years in the 1970s. But I think of his decency. He didn't run dirty campaigns. He didn't do scurrilous stuff. He just had a decent streak to him. And that also is pretty rare in politics today.
Yeah. Oh, he was very decent. He was just honest to an extreme. And, well, I don't think you can be honest to an extreme. He was just a very moral, dignified, trustworthy person, and his word was gold.
I was thinking, I guess for most of your life, you know, there was John Anderson, the father, and there was John Anderson, the politician, but for Diane Anderson, I guess they were one and the same, weren't they?
Well, yes and no. He happened to have been elected to the Congress when I was just an infant, so I always knew him as a congressman growing up, and when he ran for president, I turned 21, so he was the first presidential candidate that I voted for. So in that sense, yes, there was no separation between his career and him as my father, but he was different at home than he was when he was orating on the floor of the Congress. At home, he was very gentle. He was not a harsh disciplinarian. He was non-judgmental and sweet and tender, and
he didn't orate in the kitchen, huh?
No, not at all. He read the newspapers a lot. Yeah, I would have to poke the newspaper to get his attention.
Back then when people read newspapers, right?
That's right.
1968, he's on the House Rules Committee, and he cast this critical vote that would send an open housing bill to the floor. Not many Republicans had that point of view, and this seemed to be the beginning of some kind of a evolution in John Anderson.
Right. Well, he cast the deciding vote that brought that bill to the floor from the Rules Committee. There were discussions at the dinner table, and my mother and my older sister had a lot to say about what was going on, and my father listened. So I think we did have some influence on him, his family. But I think the main influence was just what was happening right outside the back door of the Capitol, the riots, the assassination, the chaos. I think it was so close.
The unpopular war.
Yeah, it was so close to home that it just hit him right in his heart, and he realized that things had to change.
Do you have a favorite John Anderson story?
Oh, wow. I mean, personally, I just, my favorite memories of him are sitting beside him in the pew in church growing up as a child and watching him put the money in the collection plate very discreetly and listening to him sing. He had a wonderful singing voice, and that's one of my favorite memories. And just talking to him over the years, you know, he spoke to me as an equal, and he didn't treat me always like a little girl. You know, he really treated me with respect, and I appreciated that and had a very good relationship with him.
That was Diane Anderson, a daughter of John Anderson, the former Illinois congressman and 1980 presidential hopeful who died on December 3rd. You know, another former presidential candidate who died this year was Dick Gregory, the satirist and civil rights activist. In politics, in 1967, he ran a write-in campaign for mayor of Chicago. And the following year, he sought the White House as the candidate of the Freedom and Peace Party.
I feel that the two-party system is obsolete. The two-party system is so corrupt and immoral, they cannot solve the problems confronting the masses of the people in this country.
You know, I know his obituaries called him a comedian. I never thought he was, he didn't make me laugh, but he did talk about injustice, and he did try to be sardonic in many of the ways he saw the world.
Yeah, I guess I saw him more as a social, political, and economic critic, somebody who looked at the country as it was and the people as they were and who was in control and felt that there were kind of fundamental injustices. So I'm with you. I know, yeah, he's classified as someone who was sort of a comedian, but he was really a social critic at an important turning point in American culture, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a way, he was one of the first people to take celebrity in one area and try to use it, you know, in for the social good and the political good, and a real pioneer in the area of national black candidacies.
Dick Gregory died on August 19th at the age of 84.
Oh, why you look so sad? Tears are in your eyes. Come on and come to me now. Don't be ashamed to cry. Let me see you through. 'Cause I've seen the dark side too. When the night falls on you, you don't know what to do. Nothing you confess could make me love you less. I'll stand by you. I'll stand by you. Won't let nobody hurt you. I'll stand by you.
I'm Ken Rudin, and you're listening to the Political Junkie 2017 Remembrances Special. Together with political analyst Stu Rothenberg and USA Today columnist Jill Lawrence, we're taking an hour to remember the political giants and headline makers we lost this year. You know, and I was just thinking, where would we be without journalists who cover these politicians and, you know, and also uncover things at the same time? And a profession, Jill Lawrence, I think that seems under attack more than ever.
Well, it is under attack more than ever, but it's doing the greatest work ever. I mean, not the greatest work ever, maybe, but certainly I think that Donald Trump has inspired a lot of great journalism. And so it's a little bit paradoxical, but I think it's going to emerge stronger from this period of attack than it had been before. I think there is a good portion of the country that understands how much we need it. You know, you don't know what it's got till it's almost gone, right?
Gee, I wish I was as optimistic as Jill is. I wish I was as hopeful. I just don't know. I think the constant drum beating from the White House trying to destroy and demonize serious folks who are just trying to get at what's going on and why and what does it mean.
Enemy of the people, they can be called that.
Yeah, and I understand that half the country is outraged at his behavior, and more than half the country. But what still shocks me is 40% of the country, or close to that, sometimes 35, sometimes 32.
Less and less.
See, well, no, there's a NBC News Wall Street Journal poll that has the president's job approval out of 41, I believe, the most recent one, just the other day.
Which is but still he, the lowest of a first-term president.
Yeah, that's high. And we've had Gallup at 32 and like, but still, there's at least, Joe, at least a third of the country seems to agree with his crazy charges about fake news and the CNN and probably USA Today, where I look at it and I see a bunch of people who, yeah, some of them have partisan views. They have, I mean, everybody has opinions. But they're trying, they understand that the nature of the job is to put some of those opinions aside as you report on what's going on. He just, he and his supporters, it's not a matter of accepting that approach. It's, they just deny that it exists. So I'm really worried.
It's Tom Nichols, who wrote the book about the death of expertise, said it's a kind of an undermining of professionalism in general, both journalists lawyers, Bob Mueller, anyone who sets aside their views and covers the news or does their investigations.
Well, let me mention the names of some journalists who passed this year who really did, I think, outstanding work. Bill Miner helped America learn about the horrors of racial injustice in Mississippi during the civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 60s. Wayne Barrett was a Village Voice columnist and muckraker from New York who famously reported on Donald Trump, I guess since the early 1990s. Another Voice columnist, Nat Hentoff, was a strong defender of civil liberties. Charles Bartlett won a Pulitzer Prize as a Washington reporter with the Chattanooga Times, but I think he's most probably best remembered for fixing up Jacqueline Bouvier and then Congressman John F. Kennedy on a blind date. There was also Alan Colmes, who played the hapless sparring partner, the liberal hapless sparring partner to the conservative Sean Hannity on Fox News for years. And Stu, you're from New York. You may remember Gabe Pressman.
Absolutely. I love Gabe Pressman.
He was on WNBC Channel 4, which is the NBC affiliate, for more than six decades.
He was an icon in New York media, local media, cover all the political elections and going on, candidates. Gabe Pressman is there all the time. Yeah, it's great.
Hey, I'm from New York, too, and I, too, remember him.
Yeah.
A fixture in many lives.
Yeah, no, Gabe Pressman was everywhere. He was omnipresent.
Yeah.
I think he covered Jimmy Walker's administration as mayor. You know, talking about it, and Jill alluded to this, if we're talking about members of the media who died this year, Roger Ailes, I mean, he was this Republican consultant with Media Savvy, went on to launch the wildly successful Fox News channel, but of course he was ousted, you know, in the sexual harassment scandal. Guys, what's your final verdict on Roger Ailes?
Well, yeah, I guess I when I hear think of Roger Ailes, I certainly don't think of him as a journalist. Though you're right, you can include him. I mean, he put together a major news organization, didn't he? But when I think of Roger Ailes, I think back to the guy who was the ad maker,
right,
the political strategist, and he took that into kind of a journalism and created this niche as kind of advocacy journalism.
Well, before we end this conversation about members of the media who passed this year, there was Jimmy Breslin, and there were very few people like Jimmy Breslin. He was a New York City columnist who fought for the little guy, as they like to say. And I spoke with another great New York journalist, Michael Daly, just hours after Breslin's funeral in March. Here's a little excerpt.
When big things happen, and to him a big thing could be the assassination of a president, but also a big thing could also be the murder of a kid on a Brooklyn street. When big things happen, that's when you kind of really become who you are. And that's when Jimmy was really Jimmy, I think. I mean, people, there are a million stories that you laugh about. You tell Breslin stories all day and have everybody rolling on the floor. But the particularly in these days, in this era of fake news and alternate facts, I just spoke at his funeral, and one of the things I was saying was that, you know, brothers and sisters in the media, be like JB in the continued pursuit of the truth. And that's ultimately what his whole way of writing, his whole way of reporting, it was about trying to get to what's the most true.
He died at age 88, and it sounds like a full life, but everything, when I think about him and I think of your reactions and other reactions to him, it feels like he was still taken too soon.
Yeah, no, he could have done another 100 years. You know, it would have been good. But we had the years that we had, you know, and I think everybody should be grateful for that.
That was Michael Daly, a special correspondent with the Daily Beast, who knew Jimmy Breslin better than anyone. Two former senators died this year. Pete Domenici, a New Mexico Republican, served 6 terms in the Senate, where he was one of the most respected members of the chamber. Jill, Stu, did you guys know him?
I covered him for a while. He was very old school in that he was a budget expert, and he worked with the other side occasionally. He was a person who, wasn't a rabid partisan. And I mean, he was someone who was very interested in mental health issues, specifically because it affected his family. But he did work across the aisle on deficit reduction and just, the kinds of things that we don't really see very much of today. So it's, that was a loss. And when he left, he went to the Bipartisan Policy Center, which, I'm not surprised at. And he did a lot there with budget events and budget proposals, trying to get things back on track to where people could work together and make compromises and get the business of government done.
When I think of Pete Domenici, I think of the deficit hawks in the Republican Party, which is interesting and ironic because right now we have a tax reform bill where Republicans seem to have jettisoned all their concern about tax reform, except Bob Corker, who then votes for the bill. So it just shows you how different times are and how kind of the way a senator operated and how he or she viewed his or her roles have changed now, I think.
And Stu, how about this senator?
Not only is Bunning after a no-hitter, he's after a perfect ball game.
Struck him out!
That was Father's Day against the Mets, was it not?
It was, 1964. Yep.
And I remember watching that game, and I was rooting for the Mets, of course. But I followed Jim Bunning's career in the Senate closely because I have followed his career in baseball. He's, of course, one of, I think, 5 people who had no-hitters in both leagues.
Detroit and Philadelphia, right?
Yeah, Detroit and Philadelphia, yeah. And he pitched a perfect game, as you note. And he had a reputation of kind of a crotchety, cranky old man.
Cantankerous,
frankly.
Yes.
Cantankerous. Very conservative Republican who, when he left baseball, went into politics. There was a general sense that he would kind of started to fail, but he won re-election and that.
And then Mitch McConnell forced him out in 2010 because he felt he was so unpopular.
That's right.
That Mitch McConnell forced him out, tried to get his own candidate, and some guy named Rand Paul said, oh, no, I'm going to run the way I want to run.
That's
and
right.
He won the seat. You know, if Jim Bunning was not the kind of guy members of Congress wanted to hang out with, Bob Michael was the opposite. An Illinois Republican, he was the longest-serving GOP House leader in history, but he was never part of the majority. He was elected in 1956. 2 years after the Republicans lost their majority, and he retired in 1994, the year they recaptured it. True confessions, I was a... Jill, it sounds like you're chomping at the bit to talk, and I want you to talk, but I may share this with you, because I was a big Bob Michael fan. I cherished his decency and his fairness. What do you think? What do you say?
Well, I think if the Tea Party was upset with John Boehner, they would have gone absolutely out of their minds at Bob Michael.
Yeah.
he was just the kind of person that, I mean, he was a gentleman, and by necessity, because he was in the minority, he learned how to work with Democrats. And, I guess if Democrats take over the House next year, we'll find out if these Republicans will learn how to do that. But they've never had to do that, a lot of them. And, this is not the kind of government that we have anymore. So, in a sense, he's a role model, but I doubt any Republicans would see him that way.
Stu, I don't know about a role model, but I do feel that, as Jill said, he was a gentleman and he was really respected on both sides of the aisle.
Oh, absolutely. But this, now you have to go back to a different era, and you had Charlie Halleck, Bob Michael, Ev Dirksen, those kinds of Republicans were in the party's leadership. And as Jill said, Bob Michael now... I mean, he would be a poster child for the Tea Party against him as the establishment, because they used to play golf with Democrats, and they'd have the senator and House members and their spouses would have dinners with the people from the other party and their spouses, and it was such a different time. And I think what happened was conservatives concluded that people like Bob Michael were enablers. They didn't really fight hard enough. They accepted the minority status, and they weren't tough enough, and they didn't want to have sharp elbows. And I think that's true. But for some of us, those times, not the fact that the Republicans were always in the minority, but generally that there weren't sharp elbows reminds us about how the best in politics can
be. But, you know, you're absolutely right. One of the reasons that one of the reasons that Newt Gingrich decided to stand up to Bob Michael is because there were a lot of moderates in the party, like Olympia Snowe, Nancy Johnson. They all said, look, we love Bob Michael, but it's time. We've been in the minority for 40 years. That's a long time. We need somebody like Newt Gingrich.
They felt he got comfortable in the minority.
They're exactly right. And I think Michael Michael was good friends with Tip O'Neill and Tom Foley. But I think Newt said, okay, enough is enough. It's time for a new Republican Party. And that, I think, was the difference. I think that's when Congress began to change, when Bob Michael left after 1994 and Newt Gingrich took over as the minority leader and then Speaker.
It seemed like the policy differences were not as stark back then, that you know, you could always split the difference and get somewhere, and, you know, there wasn't so much ideological, if I say extremism, maybe that's going too far, but, you know, people from districts where, you know, certain things were expected of them, and they ran on certain things, and they stayed true to them regardless of whether they were able to accomplish anything or not. That just was not how things were back then. You know, even though welfare reform, the big Clinton-Gingrich compromise, you know, the parties managed to move to the middle, both of them.
Well, in February, shortly after Michael's death at the age of 93, I spoke with his longtime press secretary, Missy Tessier.
As you know, I have had great, great, great affection for my former boss retained a really great friendship with him. Even after he retired, and several of us who were in his kitchen cabinet kind of, you know, stuck together, and we'd have quarterly breakfasts with him over at the Capitol Hill Club, and he'd, you know, I would help him talk to reporters even after he left public life. Folks like yourself would still be calling me up and saying, hey, you know, can I get Bob's take on this? I'm kind of looking for, you know, for either, and it was usually to comment on what kind of a path he might see forward to bring people together and come to a common sense legislative solution for whatever the big issue was on the table. And, you know, I always thought it was great that people still reached out to me long after Bob retired, and I was always happy to help them out.
You know, it's so rare to have a member of Congress, former or current, that when somebody passes, everyone was saddened, Democrats and Republicans. I guess he just represented an era that's no longer.
That could be. I think that people now are speaking out more from the edges of the party, and are, because of the voters that they're listening to and others, they tend to be less inclined toward trying to seek common ground, and they want to win on their issue. And there's a lot of value in that, and there's a lot of value in really, really fighting hard for what you believe in and for what your constituents or what you as their legislator, you know, want to represent in that point of view. But the art of hammering out a big deal and the art of hammering out, you know, some way for the parties, you know, the different people to come together and sit in a room until they have a path forward is what I lament the most in these, you know, these years that have passed since I worked with Bob.
Let me tell you a quick story of how I met him. I was with ABC News.
Yep, and I met you when you were with ABC.
That's right, and this is, I think, 1989, and we're taking a train from Washington to Philadelphia. It was like the anniversary of the Constitution or something like that. And I go over to Bob Michael, and I'm wearing a button. I figured I would meet him, and I'm wearing a button that says, re-elect Harold Velde to Congress.
Oh, good Lord.
And, of course, Harold Velde was the guy Bob Michael used to work for as chief of staff, right?
That's right. He was his predecessor.
So when he saw, and Harold Velde, I think, was chairman of the, or at least not chairman, maybe he's chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee. But anyway, when Bob saw the button, he had this, you know how this uproar, this deep baritone laugh he would have. You know, I just liked him from that initial moment. It was just so great.
Oh, I know. You know, and my job as press secretary was made more difficult by the fact that Bob was an extremely honest person and thought that he needed to answer every question that was ever posed to him by a member of the press. He stopped my heart a few times. somebody in the cloakroom would call me and say, you know, Bob's talking to some reporters. You might want to get over here.
We can't have that, can we?
Right. And, you know, frankly, I think that, you know, it's very helpful for a democracy and it's very helpful for a legislative body for reporters to have access to, you know, to somebody's unvarnished opinion. But, you know, considering the fact that, you know, there was some, you know, sometimes, you know, he got a little far ahead of himself or whatever, you know, it was just nice to be there when he would have a good conversation with folks. But it's hard to say that, you know, a hard part of your job is working as a press secretary for someone who wanted to give an honest view to answer a question and who also didn't seek out a whole lot of press attention.
I was going to say, did he ever talk about frustration or regrets of never being in the majority?
Oh, every day. Only every day, Ken. But yeah, it's frustrating. But you have to find your victories, and you know, kind of keeping your conference, you know, your membership in line when you have so very little to give back to them in terms of leadership and in terms of, you know, perks and things like that, and just kind of, you know, taking a victory, you know, on a rules battle or something that you know, your members can't even take home to their districts and say, well, we won this rules fight, you know, and it's like everybody's like, you know, what is that? What does that mean? Why is that important to me?
Talking about that time when Tom Foley allowed Bob Michael to take the speaker's chair, I had Bob on this show not long after Tom Foley died in 2013, and we talked about that moment. Let me play a little bit of that.
It was a very emotional day for me, for that matter, because Tom was giving his swan song as he was leaving the Congress. You know, after that defeat up in his district, I was leaving under a little different terms because I just voluntarily decided that I wasn't going to be running again. But Tom knew me well enough that, and having been around there that long, that, boy, that would really be something to actually preside over the House, if only for a couple of minutes.
There's a lot to be said for what he accomplished, a lot to be said for what needed to succeed him. If that's an argument that some would make, then you can't turn back the clock.
I'm sorry, Missy, you lost a friend. I'm sorry for all of us, you know, that we lost Bob. But I'm glad we had him for as long as we did, and I think we miss him more than we know.
I think we do. Thank you so much, Ken. I really had a good time talking to you.
That was Missy Tessier talking about her old boss, Bob Michael. The former Republican leader in the House, Michael died on February 17th at the age of 93. I'm Ken Rudin, and you're listening to the Political Junkie 2017 Remembrances Special. Several major leaders in the conservative movement died this year, including the pollster Arthur Finkelstein, the pundit Cato Byrne, and the consultant Victor Gold. David Keene, the former head of the American Conservative Union, knew all three and joins us now to talk about them. David, thanks again for being on the program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Ken.
Well, thank you. And you know what? One of the three I just mentioned, Vic Gold fascinates me the most. I mean, he was Vice President Spiro Agnew's press secretary, but there was something about him, and I never met him, but I know everybody I knew who knew him said that, you know, he was funny in person. He was actually very funny in person, but he could be intense and irritable and terrifying. That was Vic Gold, right?
He could be all of those things. You know, anybody who met him, if you remember the old Reader's Digest, had the most unforgettable character I've ever met. Anybody who met Vic Gold would have Vic in the top five finalists if he or she was asked to write that section. Because Vic was a character, he was very important in the early days and even the later days of the conservative movement. And to have known him was both an honor and a pleasure once you got used to the fact that he could explode at any moment.
Yeah. Well, he started right. Didn't he start with the Goldwater campaign? Wasn't he a Goldwater guy?
He was the deputy press secretary in the Goldwater 1964 campaign. And famously, as the campaign ended, the press corps presented him with a straitjacket in the hopes that perhaps that could control some of the things that, he was up to. But I worked with him. I knew him before because he wrote for National Review, but I hadn't met him until I went to work for Vice President Agnew. And when I got there, the vice president and his entourage were on the road, so I settled into my office, and then one day I heard this screaming in the next room, and I went in there, and it was Victor Gold, and he was erupting like Vesuvius. And then he spotted me, and he stopped all of a sudden and came over and very quietly said, "Hi, welcome to the staff. I'm Vic Gold." And then he exploded again and went back to what he was doing. And in those days, and I've told this story, in fact, at his memorial service, every once in a while, the vice president, Vice President Agnew, wouldn't take his advice, and Vic would get really upset. And when he got really upset, he would quit. And our offices were on the second floor of the old executive office building. The vice presidents were at one end. The press secretaries were at the other. And I was sort of in the middle. And when he got really upset, everybody else had this government-issued faux Williamsburg furniture. You know, you've been in those offices. But Vic had moved his 1960s Jewish PR firm furniture into his office, so it was outfitted differently. And when he really got mad, he'd call a moving van to move his office furniture out and leave, at which point we would have to go to the vice president and say, "Listen, Mr. Vice President, Vic's very important to us and to you, so you need to go apologize to him." And the vice president would say, "But I didn't do anything wrong." And we'd say, "That's really not the point. You've got to do it." So the vice president would get up out of his office, and he'd walk down the hall. He'd go to Vic's office and apologize. Vic would calm down, call the moving service, and tell him not to show up and decide to stay until the next time he erupted. That story became important because he later came back into politics after having worked at the Washingtonian for some years and vowed never to get into politics again. But he came back for George H.W. Bush's 1980 campaign. And he was on the road with Bush because Bush notoriously had sort of a political tin ear and didn't react as well as he should sometimes. And Vic was there to overreact, and between the two of them, things worked fine. But at some point, Vic got angry, blew up, and decided to go home and abandon it, at which point Jim Baker and I, who were running the campaign, said to each other, "Uh-oh, this is really bad because one of us might have to go out on the road," which we didn't want to do. So I said, "Not a problem." And I told him about my experience working with Vic in the Agnew office, and I said, "We just have to get George Bush to apologize to Vic, and then Vic will go back."
Another apology that made no sense.
Right. So we got him on the phone, and Bush is in many ways an admirable character, but also bullheaded, and he didn't want to do it. But eventually I talked him into it, and so he said, "Okay, I'll call him, and I'll do it." And he hung up. Baker and I congratulated each other, and about 20 minutes later the phone rang, and our candidate said, "Nice work, Keene. That was great advice." I said, "Oh, it worked?" He said, "Well, I called and apologized to Vic, and he told me what I could do to myself and hung up on me."
Now, another one of the three who passed this year was Cato Byrne. Now, she worked on James Buckley's 1970 race.
Cato Byrne was an intern in Jim Buckley's Senate office in, I believe, about 1970. She went on, of course, to a distinguished career, was on Crossfire, was on a number of TV programs, headed the National Review Institute, and was a key person in the evolving National Review of the 2000 on. So she's missed in that way by an awful lot of people and was very influential.
And there was Arthur Finkelstein?
And Arthur was not as much a character as Vic Gold, but he was certainly in the same league. Arthur was got his start with that campaign, the Jim Buckley campaign of 1970. He was an analyst for one of the network's political divisions, but volunteered to analyze poll data and work up strategy for the Buckley third-party campaign in 1970 against the incumbent Charlie Goodell and the Democrat Dick Ottinger. That was successful. He went on to form a polling and consulting company. Famously, he's the fellow who said X is too liberal for Y. He's too liberal for Oklahoma, too liberal for Iowa, too liberal for wherever.
Generic ads. He would do generic ads.
And then he went to Israel and said the Labor Party candidate was too liberal for Israel. he was a master of analyzing poll data. back during the Nixon years, the Nixon administration would have someone take a poll, and then they would hire three or four other pollsters to take copies of that poll, lock themselves in a room, and analyze it so they could look at the different analysis of the polls. Arthur did some of that work for the Nixon administration, for the Nixon campaign in 1972, and was valuable because he could spot issues, mostly, as it turns out, social issues, that could divide the electorate in favor of the candidate he was working for.
David, thank you for your memories, and I will be giggling about Vic Gold for the rest of the week.
It's my pleasure. They're all three going to be missed, but I tell you, I miss Victor Gold every day.
David, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That was David Keene, the former head of the American Conservative Union, who talked about the deaths of three leading figures of the right, Vic Gold, Cato Byrne, and Arthur Finkelstein. One of the big political stories of the year was a stunning victory of Doug Jones, a liberal Democrat, over Roy Moore for a Senate seat in Alabama. Prior to that, I would say the most memorable election in recent Alabama history was the race for governor in 1970. That was between George Wallace, a former governor who had run for president in 1968 and who was planning on running again in 1972, and Albert Brewer, who had succeeded to the governorship in 1968. It was more than a simple Democratic primary. It was also about the future of George Wallace, which the Nixon White House desperately wanted to halt in its tracks.
In an Alabama's Democratic gubernatorial primary, for the first time in years, there is no overwhelming favorite, in spite of the presence of a nationally known name. Nelson Benton has the story.
There is no doubt that a large number of Alabama voters want as their next governor the man who staged the flamboyant third-party campaign for the presidency. But there is considerable doubt whether enough of them want George Wallace to vote him back into the governor's mansion.
When I get to be your governor, not before I'm inaugurated, but the day after I'm elected, I'm going to tell Mr. Nixon, you promised to give our schools back. I'm going to say, if you don't give our children back, and our schools back, like you promised in 1968. Since we elected you, we might just see that you are defeated in the year 1972 if you don't do that.
In effect, Wallace is running principally against the Nixon administration. His principal opponent is running against George Wallace. Albert Brewer, who became governor at the death of Wallace's wife, Governor Lurline Wallace, seeks re-election on his record. But there are discrete code phrases in the Brewer rhetoric, phrases like full-time governor, an allusion to Wallace's national ambitions.
I don't believe you want a governor. Who doesn't want to be governor and to work for you for the next 4 years? And I'm here tonight to tell you, I want to be your governor, and I'll work full-time for you for the next 4 years.
Albert Brewer died in January at the age of 88. And his primary contest with George Wallace in 1970 is one of the most famous and nastiest in the history of the state. Steve Flowers is an Alabama political commentator and author of Goats and Governors, Six Decades of Colorful Alabama Political Stories. Steve, I guess if we're going to talk about Albert Brewer, we need to start with the race for governor in 1966.
Wallace could not run for re-election because it was a secession bill that had failed in the Senate, so he ran his wife, Lurline. And Lurline and his stead, and it was a weekend nod, he says, I'm going to be your number one advisor. So Alabamans elected his wife, Lurline, who was a political novice, who'd never been around politics, and she beat 10 male opponents, including with five state senators, two sitting congressmen, two former governors, and the agriculture commissioner. Beat them all without a runoff.
And when Lurline Wallace was elected in 1966, her lieutenant governor was?
Albert Brewer.
Right.
Who had won on his own. He'd beaten two states, and he was governor. Lurline succumbed to cancer 2 years into her term in 68. Brewer became governor, and he was not the race baiter that the Wallace were. He was a pro-business, cut-and-dried, stay-home-and-stick-to-your-knitting-business-type governor. He was what the South, what we refer to as having a new South governor.
So basically, so Lurline Wallace dies in 1968, Albert Brewer becomes governor, and George Wallace says, no, I want this job back. And so it's Brewer versus Wallace in the 1970 primary.
Classic race.
And given the fact that Wallace had run for president in 1968, was talking about running again in 1972. The last thing President Nixon wanted was somebody taking away Southern votes from him for his reelection in 72, right?
So they wanted to kill Wallace off, and they sent $400,000 in cash into the state race for Brewer in a brown paper bag from Nixon, came out in Watergate, and people knew that money had come. $400,000 back then was like $4 million today.
Talk about Wallace's tactics in the runoff.
Most racist tactics I've ever seen in my life. The northern counties of the state are the most white and the most anti-integration counties. There's no black folks up there in the northern part of the state, north of Birmingham, a lot of people. And Wallace dropped pamphlets on those counties and said, called Brewer, you know, in bed with the black folks. His daughters were dating black guys. His wife was an alcoholic. It was the dirtiest thing he ever saw in life. Called Brewer gay. But Brewer led him in the first runoff with black support, a 95% black support, and about 95% upscale white support. But Wallace had the blue-collar whites. But in the runoff, Wallace had ads showing boxes in Tuskegee, Macon, Selma, and black boxes that showed that Brewer had gotten 595 votes and Wallace had gotten 15 in certain black boxes around the state. And he came out with a big, bold thing on television. He said, do you want the black bloc vote, communist black leaders collecting your governor? And he didn't use the N-word, but it was pretty close to it. Do you want these people electing your governor? And that got those whites out in North Alabama, and they beat Brewer in the runoff.
Steve Flowers is an Alabama political analyst and commentator. He talked about Albert Brewer, who was briefly the governor of Alabama, until his memorable, unsuccessful, and ugly contest with George Wallace in 1970. Brewer died in January at the age of 88. Let me turn back once more to political analyst Stu Rothenberg and Jill Lawrence of USA Today. I don't know how you can describe 2017. I mean, we keep saying we've never seen a year like it. We probably said that after 2016. This is more surreal than ever. But in addition to all that we lost, and we lost a lot of decorum and common sense and civility, but we lost people that in many ways made politics a more respectable institution.
Well, I think you're right, but what we're seeing is kind of a change of eras of how our politics proceeds, but more than that, kind of culturally, how we talk to one another, look at how the media continues to become more polarized with the pro-Trump people and the anti-Trump people becoming more vocal. The president is more divisive than he was 2 weeks ago, and he always seems to crank it up. And the kind of the people who are at the forefront of the discussion often are the people who are louder and more confrontational. It will be interesting to see, frankly, what the longer term fallout of this current what do you call the current period
hell?
On sexual no on oh. on the kind of sexual harassment
impropriety
and, yeah. To see whether that changes the way people talk to one another and about one another. I would hope so, but I'm not sure that that's likely.
Well, you know, in a way, this has been a continuum that started with that congressman, I think, Wilson, getting up on the floor and yelling, "You lie," at the president.
Joe Wilson of South Carolina, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm hoping that the president right now is kind of the epitome of that trend, and we're going to start moving back to a more civil dialogue. And I do think that there's going to be a huge increase in women in Congress and in state houses and, you know, just all throughout the government. And I frankly, as a woman and just as a human, I think that's a good trend. So hopefully the sexual misconduct wave has crested and the incivility wave is cresting right now. And, you know, we can only go up from here.
Jill Lawrence is a commentary editor and columnist at USA Today. Stu Rothenberg is a senior editor at Inside Elections and can also be found at StuRothenberg.com. Jill and Stu, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing your thoughts and memories of those who left us.
Thanks, Ken. Have a safe holiday season and a safe and healthy 2018.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Jill, you didn't say as much nice things about me as Stu just did.
Ken, I really hope your holiday season surpasses any previous.
That was the right answer. Guys, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Before we go, I want to mention three people who were friends of mine who I would like to honor here. David Hess was a longtime Capitol Hill correspondent for Knight Ridder, who was incredibly generous with his support and counsel to me when I was with ABC News covering Congress in the late 1980s. Terry Michael was a former press secretary for the Democratic National Committee, who later headed up the Washington Center for Politics and Journalism. That was a launching pad for many young journalists coming to the nation's capital. And a special farewell to a close friend, Ed Greelegs, a former chief of staff to Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, whose knowledge of and love for Capitol Hill was such a joy to experience. He had more stories about Congress and politics than anyone I knew, and he was admired and respected by more people in this business than you can count. He was a dear friend, and I miss him tremendously.
If I had a photograph of you, or something to remind me, I wouldn't spend my life just wishing.
Thanks for listening to the Political Junkie 2017 Remembrances Special. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. There you'll also find my annual column with a more thorough list of political figures who passed away this year. Again, that's at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, or if you want to share any of your own special remembrances of the past year, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin, wishing you happy holidays, and we'll see you in 2018.